happened in the past, I still wanted us to have a future together. Tragically, I think it is common in our culture to wait for someone else to do the right thing before we are willing to. We want them to make it right before we choose to move on. We want an apology before we can forgive. But the gospel just doesn't operate that way. And we, as kingdom carriers, shouldn't either. As much as I wish it didn't work this way, forgiveness is an action, not a feeling. As many times as I've forgiven people over the course of my life, I can't remember a single time when I felt like forgiving them. It's always been, at least the best my memory is allowing me to recall at the moment, a very intentional choice. And only after the choice do the feelings follow. And sometimes the feelings take an incredibly long time to line up with your choice. At least that's been true for me. As we got together that morning, we all hugged and sat at tables as the kids played nearby. We laughed and told stories and had awkward pauses where I'm sure we both wanted to bring up the situation but didn't. All the while, with every word and forgiving glance, we were laying boards, mending ropes that were almost torn through and choosing to build up rather than tear down. Peace floated over me like an ocean wave that day, and without saying so, we all knew a page had turned. It's crazy the giddiness that fills your heart when you partner with grace and say no to offense. So often we want God to use us mightily for the kingdom, but then we don't want to roll up our sleeves and get dirty in the messes that come with it. But the reality is, love is messy. It's not tidy or convenient, and it certainly doesn't always need tending at the exact time we have the capacity to tend it. We have to make time for what we know is right. When Jesus built the bridge between us and God through his death on the cross, it became the messiest love ever recorded, and the world is still being washed in the wake of it. It was tear-stained, blood-covered, flesh-torn open, and most definitely not convenient. It was a choice to forgive, a choice to surrender, a choice to give grace, a choice to trade his will for the Father's, and a choice to lay down his life for ours. All in the name of the greatest love we will ever know. He paid the ultimate price to build a bridge for us, to let bitterness and sin and ugliness and selfishness drown in the wake of love. And now it's our duty and our honor as believers to do the same. To live a life where the wake of his love through our actions covers all. And ultimately, to build bridges through our love from a lost world to him. Chapter 14. Mouths of Babes. Having a parent that listens creates a child who believes he or she has a voice that matters in this world. Rachel Macy Stafford. Being a mama is insanely hard work. Raising tiny people to become responsible adults is blow your mind challenging. Whether you're in the wiping stage, constantly tending bottoms and noses and faces and mirrors and counters, or you're learning how to handle an empty nest and random phone calls with your grown little loves who are now on their own, nothing I have found is more challenging or rewarding as being a mama. With a teenager, a tween, and a preschooler, I find peanut butter stains and piles of laundry feeling more like home than clean floors and pretty candles. Juggle that with having to actually get dressed in real clothes to watch a choir performance or a football game, and it's enough to make me wave my flag of surrender altogether. It's tough and exhausting. Most days I don't even feel like myself because I'm just so tired. But the ticking of the clock and the gravity of how short our time together really is has caused me to shift almost everything in the last few years. I adore what I do, and the work I get to throw myself into feels like a gift to my soul and breath to my lungs. But I have to be careful not to let it completely overtake my heart and leave the people I love most without a mama who's actually paying attention. It's a fight to keep my head in the mom game most days. It doesn't give out rewards and accolades the same way a business success does. But the fruit of a well-tended family goes so far beyond the fruit of a well-tended business. This season we are in has me pressing my face up against the windows of my own home and reevaluating everything. I'm learning that I need to be my children's mama first and everything else second. I need to spend an hour a day on the computer for work instead of 10. I need to put down my phone and seize the moments, push the swing, let them help with dinner, show them how to paint, use a power drill, and plant a garden. It's time to put down my checklist and take back their childhood. As the lines on the growth chart get higher and higher and their eyes are getting closer and closer to looking straight into mine without a stepping stool, I'm reminded that the seeds we plant in their tiny little hearts will become huge plants one day. Plants that bear fruit and take on lives of their own. It's caused me to wonder if they will bear fruit of love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, faithfulness, and self-control. Or will the seeds we are planting and watering inside them grow into fear, sorrow, confusion, frustration, isolation, meanness, infidelity, and indulgence? I've been convicted of this a lot lately, and I feel blessed that I have been. Because if I hadn't, I may have missed an opportunity a while back that went on to affect thousands of families around the world. But it started with simply showing Isaiah that his voice mattered and that his ideas, his God nudges, were worth pursuing. A few years back, our son Isaiah, who was 7 at the time, came and sat with me at the kitchen table as I was having my quiet time and planning the day. I was filling in the prompts in the intentional days journal I'd created a few months before, and Isaac found it the perfect time to cozy up next to me and fill his quality time, physical touch, love language. I continued writing, reading, and answering all of the questions he had about what I was up to while rubbing his back with my other hand. He was very invested and curious, and oddly, it was one of those mysterious times where I knew in my spirit it was time to pay attention. "Mom, can I have a journal like that?" he asked. "I want to have a place to write all of those things just like you do." "Of course," I responded, quickly affirming him. I offered him one of the extra journals I had in the garage, but since they were adorned with beautiful hand lettering and pink peonies throughout, he kindly refused and glanced back at me with the cutest, slightly grossed-out grin. Knowing the one I had at home wasn't an option, we opened the computer and began searching for kids' quiet time journals, and to our surprise, we didn't find any. There were lots of devotionals for kids and tons of books and Bibles, but nothing as interactive as what we were looking for. "It doesn't look like there are anybody," I said, "but I will keep looking, and if I find something, I'll see if it's something you'd like." Without even hesitating, Isaiah said, "What if we make one, Mama? Like the one you made, but for kids. Could we do that?" I was a little startled at his initiative and passion, but I had a choice in that moment to lean in or let it pass by. I could have easily said, "You know what, buddy? That's a great idea, but that's a really big project. I don't think it's something we can do." But something inside me didn't let that happen. My Holy Spirit meter was telling me this was one of those moments that could change so much for his little heart. What I didn't realize at the time was how much it would do for mine. It had been a rough year for him at school, and his sensitive soul was still recovering from the sting of it all. This project felt like the perfect way for us to do something fun together, and for him to feel like his ideas were valuable and worth investing in. I pulled out a bunch of copy paper and laid it on the table. I got a pen and some colored pencils and asked him to mock up some pages with the questions he wanted to ask. Ava, who was 9 then, joined in the party too. And soon, our whole family was around the table dreaming up ideas and collaborating on the new project. The next thing I knew, I had jumped onto Photoshop and turned their sketches into digitalized pages. While I was doing that, I had them both draw their own covers for their personalized journals. Then we scanned them, and within a few hours, I had uploaded the pages to a website to get their very own custom journals printed. When the journals arrived, the kids loved them so much that sitting down for a daily quiet time together became a quick habit and a welcomed ritual. And the conversations that were sparked during our times together became my absolute favorite part of the day. By this time, my entrepreneurial brain was spinning, and I couldn't help but think that if we were enjoying them so much, there must be other families who'd enjoy them too. I texted my dear friend Jordan, who'd previously told me that she had dreams of illustrating children's books, and asked if she could help bring the project to life. I had a vision of creating characters that kids could get attached to and feel comfortable with. I thought it fitting that these cute little critters would lead them in their adventures of faith. After a few hundred texts and several rough sketches, we'd honed in on the concept, and Archer the Fox and his band of friends were born. With a few more texts and some idea mapping, the first Adventures with Archer journals were officially underway. Since that day, we've gone on to release and sell out of 5 different versions of the journals, one for every season and a special Advent version. We've shipped thousands of copies to families all over the world, and it never gets old seeing photos of children I've never met experiencing their own quiet times because of this tool. And honestly, it's all because of Isaiah's sweet little heart and my pausing long enough to actually notice. The magic of this story is that things like this don't just happen. They are intentionally tended. Instead of simply nodding my head and not really paying attention, I had to be present enough to truly listen to Isaiah. And then, when he spoke, I had to stop what I was doing and engage with his idea. When the idea started to take root, I had to do design work on the computer and call in reinforcements for the illustrations. I had to invest countless hours of time and research and thousands of dollars in production and design costs. There were many, many steps that took us from a fun conversation one morning to launching a complete children's book series with customers all over the world. But it all started with making the intentional choice to lean in and listen, to wake up and pay attention to what was unfolding right before my eyes. And I'm so thankful I didn't miss it. Our children are so gifted, friend, so very gifted. They ache to be seen just as we all do. That longing is not something that appears out of nowhere as we grow. It's always there. Praying and hoping for a chance to do something great or think of something world-changing. And our kids have the ability to change the world tucked in their tiny hearts. It's time for them to see us seeing them, to give them credit and opportunity and applause. to give them a chance to succeed instead of assuming they'll fail. Sometimes it's pushing aside our own mindset. Their ideas can't be as good as ours, so why even try? Or, we have so much going on, we can't possibly take the time to sew into such an involved project. I'd love to say that I'm always as attentive and that every idea that bursts out of my children's mouths gets as much attention as that one did, but that's not true. The truth is, not every idea is even good enough to tend, but it is good enough to be heard attentively. It's not as easy as jumping into every whim they have, and I certainly wouldn't have taken all of this so far if the Holy Spirit hadn't prompted me to and my husband hadn't supported me. So please, oh please, don't throw common sense and wisdom out the window in pursuit of being a supportive mom. But I do want to challenge you to truly pay attention, to look up from what you're doing and not only listen to them, but to truly hear them and act on what you're hearing. Keep looking them in the eye. Keep praying over the words and dreams and ideas that come blubbering out of their little hearts. And ask the Father what to do with it all. It might just surprise you and the whole world too. Chapter 15, Never Ending. While we wait for our callings to present themselves, they are waiting on us to wake up. Jeff Goines. My life seems to ebb and flow between the waves of ideation, productivity, and fulfillment of the dreams God places on my heart. It's what keeps me up at night and makes me come alive. If I feel the urge to lay something down, it's just a matter of time, usually not even a few hours, before I've dreamed up something else to fill the blank hours of my days. It's almost as if I'm addicted to the process of it all, which I probably am. And this cycle of crazy nearly became the end of me about a year ago after laying down the conference. One day I woke up in a panic, not sure of who I was or what I was to do now that I didn't have a huge to-do list and thousands of emails to respond to. Who am I if I'm not running this event? I wondered. I had been doing it so long that it almost became my identity, and actually I completely feared that it had. Am I even valuable? Will people even care? Is everything I've worked for gone in an instant? Does it even matter what I do from here? Will I just be forgotten? The more I allowed these thoughts to swirl around in my head, the faster they seemed to come. Have you ever felt that way? Like you wouldn't matter if you weren't doing your job or being productive or making great strides toward your dreams? For months after I made the decision to close the conference, I found my thoughts arguing back and forth with each other. On one hand, I felt solid, secure, and at peace with the decision we'd made. On the other, I was fighting off all of the thoughts telling me how much I'd failed, that I had no purpose, and that nothing I did ever mattered. And by the way, even if it had mattered, I was convinced it certainly wouldn't anymore. The battle in my mind was fierce and constant, and would have taken me out completely if I'd let it. But I knew that the Lord promises to draw near to us if we draw near to Him. I begged God to speak because my own thoughts were simply too much to navigate on my own. It wasn't long before I began to ponder, what actually is a calling anyway? Is it a job? Is it this conference? Or is it possibly something completely different? I started diving into the Word and researching everything I could on calling and purpose and assignments, and even though it's become a popular topic in the Christian culture, it's not exactly an easy thing to figure out. Romans 1:6 says, including you who are called to belong to Jesus Christ. And Romans 8:28 says, we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love Him, who have been called according to His purpose. So we know that we are called to belong to Christ and that we are called according to His purpose. There were also stories of God calling others into specific things, but the Bible doesn't write out in black and white that Jenny is called to be an accountant and Logan a fireman and Billy a missionary. So it made me wonder if calling is something entirely different from what I've believed most of my life. I started wondering if maybe my calling wasn't a specific thing I had accomplished or would accomplish, but more about what I was created to spend my life doing. More specifically, I began to wonder if calling goes on forever, while a commission is something that starts and ends. The more I explored this theory, the more I realized that there seems to be a wide belief in our society that our calling is found in what we do, that being a teacher or a writer or even a mom is our greatest calling. But if that's the case, what happens to our calling when those jobs end, or when our children grow up and leave the house? Somewhere along the line, we as a culture decided that we had to put a destination around our calling, as if it were a specific job that could be explained in an elevator pitch introduction. The more God invited me into this conversation with Him, the more I started to think that our cultural beliefs about callings are likely a vast misconception. And I'm starting to feel that what we do is just a snippet of our calling and a teensy portion of our purpose. To me, it's a fleeting glimmer of our days here on earth, but there is so much more to factor into our stories. If we are one of the lucky ones, what we do will actually be an extension of what we love. But that's not always the case. And if you aren't one of those souls who's magically turned their passions into their profession, there is still hope. Because I'm starting to think that our calling has nothing to do with the words that make up our job descriptions, and everything to do with who we actually are and how we go about any job or duty. In my life, this has been a mind-blowing epiphany. I found myself asking questions like, who am I really? What am I here for? What are the things I do no matter what form they take on? How does what I am here for look when my jobs change? When I began to separate ministry leader and conference director from the lines behind my name, I felt simultaneously empty and deeply fulfilled. Staring back at me in black and white were two words, my name. Karen Stott. Who was I then? With no words and accolades following my name. When I stripped my name of titles and opened up blank space behind my name, God started writing a new story in me. He began to drop words into my heart that felt as familiar as my small hometown in Oregon's wine country. Words like builder, encourager, innovator, beautifier. I began to write them out, and it wasn't long before I saw patterns unfold that had nothing to do with job titles or task lists, and everything to do with who I was and why I believe I was created and put here during this age and time in the first place. These are the words that I had scribbled down on the page. I like to start things. I see greatness in others, and I help them see it in themselves. I have an innate gift to help others walk in the fullness of their calling and make something from nothing. I have a deep love and knack for making bland things beautiful and people feel seen. I am an experienced curator and a calling cultivator. As these words poured out, a deep sense of yes fell over me. Yes, this is what I am made for. This is what I am here for. This is what I was made to do, made to be. And the best part is that I can do all of those things in any position or job or season. I do them with my kids and with my friends and in any position I've been placed. And I think that's what makes our calling so wonderful. Most likely, we are already doing it. We just might not even know that we are. I think we need to take a moment to pause and take the pressure off of ourselves. Oftentimes, I feel like I've missed it. Like I've messed up so big that I've not only missed it for me, but I've missed it for my children, too. I get down on myself for not having this grand life's work like a professor or an inventor or a doctor. Those people always felt superior in my mind because they knew what they were passionate about, what they were good at, and they dedicated their life to it. To me, they had found their purpose. That was it. End of story. And for me, the crazy gal who never could quite land the plane, this whole finding my calling and fulfilling my purpose thing felt completely out of reach, and I was just out of luck. But as I leaned into God, he began to reveal to me another side of the story. And I must admit, being the daughter of a retired teacher and the wife of a man, starting to look at what his life will be after firefighting helped this process immensely. Isaac has the most incredible service heart I've ever seen. I've never met such an attentive, self-motivated need meter in my life. He just notices things. He has this knack of being able to survey a situation, see the needs, and know how to fix the problem or meet the need. My mom, who taught for over 40 years in our community schools, has an incredible gift of helping others understand things. She has a gift of communication and knowledge and revealing the gifts and abilities in people that they might not know are there. Both for my mom and for Isaac, their jobs are simply an extension of who they are anyway, and walking out of those titles won't hinder their callings in the slightest. It simply gives them new opportunities to use those gifts in a different setting. I have been able to encourage and beautify and cultivate callings and see greatness in others as a child growing up, as a wife, a mama, a ministry leader, a photographer, an author, and a shop owner, because that is who I am. It's who God created me to be. And I will be able to continue doing those things no matter what specific commissions or jobs or paths or opportunities God leads me in and out of. Isn't that so freeing? So beautiful? What are those things for you? I've heard it said that our calling is where our strengths and our passions collide, and I couldn't agree more. When I read those words on the paper, I can almost feel the fire rekindling and the joy resurfacing. Seeing what I have always had and will continue to have, regardless of a specific situation, overwhelms my heart with all of the good feelings. And I hope it does for you too. Every word of what I wrote in the list is a passion of mine or a strength I have discovered along the way. And I found so much beauty and rightness in both. Seeing who I really am unfold in black and white helped me realize that running a conference and leading a ministry wasn't really my calling after all. Those were simply commissions in a series of probably a dozen or more commissions that I will walk through over the course of my life. When my commission as a conference director ends, my calling continues. It just takes on different forms. When my children grow up and move out of our home, my calling doesn't graduate with them. It just morphs into something else. A burden lifted off my shoulders as the words God had whispered to my heart took up residence in my soul. Knowing that I get to use my gifts and walk in my calling in our home and with our kids and with Isaac and in whatever work God leads me into was a welcomed breath of fresh air. But knowing that laying down the conference wasn't the end to my story was also a welcomed relief. I think we all have this ache inside of us that longs for something bigger, something grand. We want to be part of the larger picture and have our lives stand for something that matters and build things that last. And the beautiful part about all of that is that each commission God leads us into is simply a role in that larger story. It's a stepping stone, a preparation. It's divinely placed, specifically timed with an eternal purpose that weaves all of these commissions together and allows us to live our greatest, holy present, fullest, joy-brimming lives that create a tapestry to reflect His greatness. I say this, friend, because I know the joy of starting a new adventure and the ache of watching it come to a close. I've opened businesses and closed them. I've started new friendships and watched them fizzle. I've had thousands in savings and I've received stacks of overdraft letters from the bank. I've built houses, sold them, and even lost them. I've had great successes and great failures. I have loved and I have lost. Through it all, the beauty I've held on to is knowing that the Lord gives and takes away. But who I am and who He is and what I've been called to do while I'm here, those things remain. No matter what, God is faithful. No matter what, He will work good in my story. No matter what, I will praise Him in it. No matter what, He will always be there. No matter what, I will encourage others to follow Him. No matter what, He is good and kind. No matter what, I will build and make beautiful. And that is what calling is. Remaining faithful to who He's created us uniquely to be and following Him into commissions and out of them as well. Step by step, season by season, commission by commission, we are called to use how He wove us to step into the good works He's already prepared in advance for us to do. No matter what. Chapter 16. Shekels. Face the fear of today instead of regret it forever. John Acuff. Fear is one of those words that I kind of despise. It's everywhere these days in a way that almost discredits its actual ugliness. It feels like it's sneaking its way into our everyday language to the point that we aren't appalled when it's brought up anymore. Conquer your fears, we're told. Look your fears in the face. Feel the fear and do it anyway. It's unending, borderline annoying, and most likely on a hand-lettered shirt in your closet. I get it. I do. But it's also like fear is one of those prickly, underwater corals that has been sanded down so much that it feels like a ping-pong ball against your skin. Where did the ugly parts of fear go? What happened to the horrifying reality of what our lives would look like in 50 years if we let fear win? I feel that before we can actually do something about this new and improved fear, we actually need to get a little real with it. We need to take off the pretty clothes of the acceptable fear we allow ourselves to have and break it down a bit. Here's the thing. We aren't born with fear. It's not something we naturally take in and own. It's placed upon us repeatedly as we learn what it's like to be human in this world. I can still remember what my life was like before fear entered the picture. I was raised on about 50 acres in the middle of nowhere, Oregon. My daddy was a logger, and up the hill from our house around a winding gravel road sat his log mill. I can still hear the sound of him cutting timber and smell the greasy, oily aroma of chainsaws mixed with the wet, earthy scent of freshly cut wood. I remember how warm my grandpa's green metal coffee thermos felt in my cold, wet hands. The way he would drive me around in the front seat of his truck and with a wink, hand me a ding-dong out of his lunch pail as though it were the most prized possession in the world. And let's face it, it was. We weren't a ding-dong family back then. If we didn't kill it, grow it, or obtain it in a 5-gallon bucket at Costco or from the clearance shelves at the bread outlet, we didn't have it. So these moments in my grandpa's truck are some of my most cherished memories with him. I can still smell the chocolate as my tiny fingers unfolded that shiny silver wrapper layer upon layer until I could taste the glorious mashup of what must have been some plastic meats sugar replacement concoction. We ran wild and free back then, my brothers and I. There were 10 kids within a few miles, all boys. And then there was me. I ran with a pack the best I knew how, and fear wasn't a word we allowed to be tattooed on our hearts. As a mother, I tremble remembering the things we did when we were our kids' ages. My poor mom, if she only knew. One of my favorite pastimes was a game my oldest brother dubbed Timber, because when we weren't helping Grandpa eat his lunch or Dad plant trees or finding licorice root to eat off tree trunks for survival purposes, we basically took on the form of the Lost Boys from Peter Pan. And as the only girl, I was the guinea pig for all of the boys' harebrained schemes. So when my brother got this super fun idea that someone should climb to the top of the trees near the swamp, I was the one nominated. When the boys at the bottom decided it would be a fun idea to take an axe to the bottom of the tree, it was me who got the opportunity to find out what it feels like to fly, at least until I landed in the muddy swamp 20 feet below. It's been 2 decades since those days in the woods with my own version of Neverland, but I still can't help but laugh every time I think about the story. I could learn so much from my younger self, the audacity, the stupidity, the bravery. Sometimes I think we need to get a little bit more stupid about following God. Webster suggests that the word stupid implies someone who goes through life making decisions that lack common sense. And I think God is all about things that lack common sense. If God were into common sense, he wouldn't have birthed the Savior from a virgin, saved a nation through a murderer, flooded an earth that had never seen rain, or created a new order where the last is first and the first is last. It just doesn't make sense, right? So take heart. If God is asking you to do something that doesn't make any sense, you're in some seriously great company. You know who I think would relate to this a bit? You know who I think would be our number one fan and would climb right up those trees with us, getting excited about falling into a swamp and doing something completely crazy and unconventional? David. I think David would be all about something like that. David is one of my favorite Bible guys, and he was all about doing stupid things out of love. As a child, David walked right up to a man literally twice his size to battle against him for his people with a slingshot and 5 rocks. Does anything about that story make sense to you? Does any part of that bring peace to your heart? No one hears that and thinks, sure, everything is going to be great. David is going to come out just fine. Let's all go get our chairs so we can get good seats for this, because this is going to go down as one of the greatest underdog hero stories of all time. No, we aren't saying that at all, and neither were his people. Imagine living in David's village back then. Imagine being his mother. Could you watch him take on a giant with a slingshot? Nope. That would not be a battle you'd want to see. If you're anything like me, you'd probably be hiding behind a tent making soup and waiting for someone to bring you news. But that's just not how David rolled. Fear didn't own him the way it does so many of us. I feel David and I will get along great in heaven. We are both a little nutty, love to dance, and are a little emotional. Okay, maybe a lot emotional. And we've both made terribly bad decisions that got swallowed in God's grace. We both dive headfirst into crazy things God asks of us. I don't think I'd be as brave as David was in the Goliath situation, but when it comes to things not involving weapons, I'm all over jumping into crazy. David isn't really a bury his shekels in the sand kind of guy. And as someone who has called a man after God's own heart, I definitely think that spirit is something that should grab our attention and cause us to reflect a bit on our own lives. Recently, I was at a women's conference hosting a booth for the Adventures with Archer journals that I designed with my kids. I got into a conversation with a few moms who came to our table, and they asked me if it was hard to start making the books. I remember hesitating and tilting my head at their question. I didn't quite understand what they were saying. What do you mean? I asked back. Well, it looks like a lot of work. Wasn't it hard to come up with all of this and get it going and ready for sale? I paused long enough to process whether or not I was going to be honest in my reply. I decided that since my face can't lie anyway, I better just be upfront with them. Nope, I said. It wasn't hard at all. I barely even thought about it. We just had the idea, so we went with it, and now here they are. The women cocked their heads, looked at me a little perplexed, and kept pressing me with questions. For the first time in my entire adult life, I started to realize that my blind jumping after God's promptings wasn't exactly a universally shared trait among Christians. Apparently, this jump-then-think trait was a unique gift that God had woven deeply into my being. I could see their wheels turning, and looking back, I wish I had asked them why they were so baffled by this concept. It made me wonder if God was pulling on their hearts about something, but they hadn't yet been brave enough to admit it to themselves or take it beyond the dream stage. As a builder, my heart breaks at things like that. Simultaneously, I'm insanely curious. What is holding everyone back? More specifically, what is holding you back? Is there something that God has been whispering to your heart or continually bringing up in your life and asking you to step out in it? What is he saying? Why aren't you doing it? What's keeping you from just following his lead? I mean, he did create you, and he, more than anyone, knows not only what you are gifted at, but also what is going to bring you the most joy and fulfillment and get you closer to who you are meant to be, right? So what's with the pause? What is stopping you from taking just one tiny step in the direction of his invitation? I think now would be a great time to stop listening and think about what God has been pressing on your heart and what the obstacle is to taking a step toward it. Go ahead. I'll wait. All of this reminds me of the men in Matthew 25 who were given talents to take care of while their master was away. Upon returning, the men to whom the master had given 5 and 2 talents had made good investments, and they were able to return to their master the original shekels plus what they had earned. When the master went to the man to whom he had given one talent, this was his response. Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here, you have what is yours. Ugh. There's that nasty word again. I was afraid. Fear of disappointing his master was the obstacle that kept this man from making a good decision that would have led to a blessing. Instead, it led to his own demise. Sadly, this story is replaying itself every day in lives of probably thousands, if not millions, of hearts all over the world. People are choosing to succumb to fear and bury their gifts in the sand because they fear what will happen if they try to use them and mess up. As a child, some of my favorite books involved alternate endings. The stories would play out, and along the way, you could choose your own adventure. Each choice turned a different page in the story that ultimately gave way to a different ending for the character's life. I don't know exactly why, or if everyone else did this too, but I couldn't help but go through the book multiple times, purposefully choosing a different answer each time to see what the outcome was. I wanted to know all of the options, and somehow that curiosity has stuck with me. I'm constantly playing out scenarios and making up endings for different situations in my own life and the lives of those around me. So I'm curious. What about you? What's your alternative ending? So much of fear is wrapped up in two tiny words. What if? What will happen if I step out, if I risk, if I fail? What happens if I put it all out on the line and it doesn't go the way I had planned? What if I do this, start this, move there, and I lose everything? What if I end up having to move back or start over or quit my dream? Those are good questions. But I have another one to ask. One that I feel is gravely more important, even eternally important. What if you don't? What would happen if you continued on your life the way it's been going? What if you didn't take that job, move to that city, take that risk, start that business, make that phone call, create that product, or reach out to that person? What would come of it? What would come of you? What if you never paused long enough to write those words God has been blazing on your heart because you fear they'll never actually be published? Or if you never applied for that promotion because you were afraid you wouldn't get it? Or never moved to that city because you were afraid of starting over? Friend, I want to flip the question in your mind. Stop asking what could go wrong and start asking what could go right. What good, amazing, incredible things could happen if you just stepped out? What are the potential blessings, opportunities, relationships? Write those down too. What you focus on will drive you one way or another. It will drive you to step out or it will drive you to stay put. And both are wise choices in their specific time. But for this story, I want to focus on whatever it is that God is tugging on your heart to do. If you focus on what could go wrong, the more you repeat those thoughts and delay action, the more rooted they become, until one day you wake up and they are fruitful, strong, hardy trees of regret. Yep, that's what I said. Because throughout my life, and from listening to countless stories from other lives, I've seen that inaction is almost always followed by regret. Following these promptings over the years has certainly cost me an immeasurable amount of grief. I've lost friends, money, businesses, opportunities. I have messed up more times than I can even account for. I have launched things that have fallen flat, created things that have never sold, and written things that were never good enough to publish. But even after experiencing disappointment from the losses, the gains, successes, and victories shine brightly in comparison. I've realized that I'd much rather face the wreckage of stepping out than the regret of staying small. I may be setting my sights too high in this regard, but a long time ago I made a pact with myself that I would live my life without regrets. I even shop this way. As a self-admitted non-shopper, I do realize that on occasion I have to make purchases to keep myself clothed. It's tragic, I know. But in this truth, I have found a very simplistic approach to filling my wardrobe. I simply ask myself, will I regret not purchasing this item? If the answer is no, I won't regret stepping away and leaving the store without said item. On the contrary, if I feel in my heart, and I know we can all relate to this feeling, that I would get home, think about whatever the object is, and likely regret not buying it in the first place, then I save myself the inevitable grief of walking away by just buying the dang thing. When it comes to my life in 50 years, I'd rather regret a step of faith I did make than one I never dared to make. Because if I dare to try something, if I step out, if I grab the hand of my ever-loving Father who is inviting me to join him on an adventure, how could that ever lead to actual failure? To me, there is just no such thing as failing, just learning. And I'd so much rather spend my life living and learning than hiding my shekels because I'm more afraid of what could go wrong than what could go right. So let's flip the question. Let's not get to the end of all of this and face the regrets of things not done, stories not lived, and faith not stretched. Let's start focusing on all that could go wonderfully right if we choose to step beyond whatever is holding us back and follow God into something that doesn't even make sense. Let's be a generation that doesn't bury our shekels in the sand, but picks up a slingshot and some stones instead. Chapter 17, Your Choice. Success is liking yourself, liking what you do, and liking how you do it. Maya Angelou. It's strange how we treat ourselves in ways we would never treat someone else. Oftentimes, we would tear someone else apart if they treated our loved ones the same way. Yet somehow, we are totally okay being completely terrible to ourselves. The expectations, the lies, the constant beating up of ourselves and comparing our shortcomings to other people's successes. The other day, I was reflecting on the beautiful sisters God has brought into my life. Two through my brothers and one through my husband, each so vastly different from the other, but all beautiful, powerful, and purposeful in their own ways. One of them is a stay-at-home mama who runs her business from her home. Another stays home with her three boys and leads a women's ministry at her church. The third works late-night nurses' shifts, juggling kid duties with my brother who works at the sheriff's department. As I was thinking about them, I was struck by the insane beauty and blessing we all have to create the lives we want around what matters the most to us. Yet with this freedom, we've somehow created a culture that celebrates others' lives and discounts our own. What's good for her is no longer just good for her. Now it also equals good for her, bad for me. I watch through the lenses of social media and get a chance to peek in on the lives of incredible women all over the world. Some are filling their days gathering eggs and getting their hands dirty in the garden. Others are teachers, oilers, missionaries, speakers, knitters, homeschoolers, or students, each one doing amazing things with what they've been given. Yet on occasion, I struggle deeply with the fact that they have it all together, and thus, I must not. Their children are clean, or their cabinets are white, or they are saying something clever and encouraging, while I can't even figure out which button makes the coffee turn on in the morning. This round and round in my head nags me and makes me feel I must be doing something wrong, because I'm not as color-coordinated, well-spoken, creative, or well-connected as the pretty girl staring at me through my phone who obviously showered this morning, while I tucked my hair in a messy bun and worked in my pajamas. Running my own business just adds to the crazy. Throw three kids in the mix and I can basically just commit myself right now. It's a lot to manage. And the constant swirling of thoughts that everyone must be doing it right except me makes the battle even fiercer and my heart weaker. Why do I do this to myself? Why do I let the lies win when I know that other women aren't the standard for my life or happiness? Why do I get down on myself whenever I see someone execute their business better than I do or launch an idea before I get around to it? Or take a day off to go to the beach with their family when we haven't done that in months. No matter what someone else is doing or what kind of life they are living, it seems I can find a way to turn it into a lie that I am not measuring up. And worse, that I'm actually completely messing up at this whole life thing in general. It reminds me of the scene in Baby Mama, when Tina Fey's character Kate is talking to Amy Poehler's character Angie, who's Kate's surrogate mom. Angie's character's kind of a screw-up and seems to have believed a whole slew of lies about herself and her worth. Somewhere along the way, she stopped thinking she could do anything differently than what she had learned was her normal. One day, Kate said to her, "Angie, you can still have a completely different life." That line always gets me, like a slap in the face to wake up and realize we have entirely more control than we sometimes give ourselves credit for. It's so easy to get down on ourselves about the lives we live and the situations we find ourselves in. It's so easy to whine about what we don't have in the light of what everyone else seems to have. But we need to wake up and realize that these pity parties can actually kill our purpose. Getting down on ourselves about what we don't have and the lives we aren't living will actually build a higher fence between us and the lives we ultimately long for. One thing I love so much about my sisters is how drastically different they are. And yet they all seem so fulfilled and at peace in the roles they've filled their lives with. It's a beautiful picture that puts to death the lie that good for her means bad for me. It cuts the string that holds us in bondage to the lie that the only success that can ever be found is in her way of life or her way of mothering or her business model. And who is this infamous her we are all chasing after in the first place? Beauty and true fulfillment are found in the realization that my life doesn't have to look the same as everyone else's to be successful. That a successful, bright, beautiful, fully alive life can be built out of whatever I want to fill it with. And no one is better at measuring what that looks like than I am. And no one is a better compass to uncover it than Christ. This is one of the most liberating things I've discovered in recent years. especially in the digital age of entrepreneurialism. My days don't have to look like anyone else's in order to be successful or filled with deep purpose. And neither do my businesses, my kids, my marriage, my childcare situation, my days off, my vacation, or my income level. When I fully embraced this truth, it was as if someone reached down and lifted the veil from my eyes and hundreds of bricks from my shoulders. These lives of yours and mine are filled with thousands and thousands of choices. And we are the ones who get to seek God for direction, and then we get to choose. Sometimes a completely different life is but one choice away. Beyond all of the ways God leads us in our lives, there are also plenty of choices left to us. We've been given the gift to seek after him, to follow his lead, and then to choose. The Bible tells us how to love and how to live. It leads us in the way of forgiveness and walking righteously, but it doesn't lay out every single decision we will ever make. It doesn't tell us how much money we should make or what kind of job to do. It doesn't tell us to say yes to the opportunity or to pass it up. It doesn't tell us where to move, what to create, and whom to marry. We are blessed with the ability and the freedom to make choices. Isn't that just the most beautiful, loving gift from our Father? So this is where it really gets fun. We have the incredible blessing of deciding what success means for us and for our family in any given season. And the best part is the definition can change whenever we want. Over the course of our marriage, success to me has taken on the forms of staying home with our newborn baby, homeschooling our son, juggling businesses and toddlers, and now settling into the rhythms of working only while the kids are in school. And embracing this ebb and flow as the tides turn and the seasons change and the lines on the growth chart in the hall get higher and higher has been the most refreshing and restorative gift in my adult life. I've had financial goals from making enough money to take our family to Hawaii or to pay for private school, all the way to saving enough to buy a vacation home or building an international family business. As it stands right now, success for me involves a deep commitment to being present and whole and excitedly engaged with the people who mean the most to me. It means working while my kids are in school and having the discipline to close my laptop and keep my phone in another room when they are home. It means saying no to travel so I can say yes to chaperoning the field trip to the pumpkin patch or to teaching my daughter and her friends how to put on makeup. It means taking a break from all the sports commitments so we can say yes to gathering around the table to truly connect as a family every single night. And just a little side note, if you're an exhausted mama, running your kids from one practice to another, throwing cheeseburgers at them from the front seat of your car, I feel you. That was us too. Last year, as I started planning for the week's meals, I realized that we were only home maybe one night a week all together for dinner. We had cross-country practice from 3 to 5:30 and football from 5 to 7, and we spent all of our time in the car, divided by activities and not connecting with our children, and there was no end in sight. As soon as these ended, basketball would start, and then baseball and track in the spring, giving us a 3-week window before football started again in the fall. Now, I love sports. I grew up an athlete, and I love the camaraderie, the discipline, and the team spirit, but the whole thing began to really wear on my mama heart, and I found myself praying that it would all just stop. And then I remembered that we have a choice in all of this. I remembered that what we are allowing into the rhythms of our children's days were the building blocks of their childhood. This is what they will remember. And all too soon, our time to bring all of our little birds to the nest each night together will be over. So I stopped it. We said we needed a break to take some time off, and we stopped the cycle. Because, friend, I was exhausted, and so were they. We were all falling into not good versions of ourselves because we were just so tired and overwhelmed. We were missing out on connecting with our kids, on laughing together, on just being us, and we weren't having family dinners anymore. Our family was slowly becoming what so many people talk about as two ships passing in the night in their marriages, but this was with our kids. And for what? So they could have more active lifestyles? So we could check off all of the boxes of proper kid experiences? I don't even know why. It just wasn't worth it for us. So we stopped. We rewrote the rules for our family and decided that we would only commit to 2 team sports a year, and they couldn't be consecutive. I just can't handle 6 months straight of the madness. And you know what? The kids are happier too. At first I feared their sad hearts or that they would feel left out, but it hasn't been that way at all. We do activities as a family and we get out with each other. And even more importantly for us, we are connected. We are whole. We are laughing again. There isn't division and crazy and stress and pressure and rushing like there was before. There's peace and quiet and time for conversations and painting nails and playing games and gathering around the table. And it's been the best decision we've made in a long time. But please remember, this is success to me and mine. This is what feels good and right and joy-filled for us in this season. If doing all the sports for each of your kids means success to you, then by all means do them. It's your choice. And it's okay to keep on keeping on or to reevaluate and change the rules when you feel they need changing. As each season or goal or dream changes, I have the freedom to just roll with it, and so do you. We get to believe and trust that God will fulfill his purpose in us as we continue to keep him at the center, stay pliable to his promptings, and pick up, lay down, step out, or stop as he leads. The best part of embracing this epiphany is the freedom found in a place that used to hold me captive. Now, instead of feeling less than or outdone or like I'm missing out or falling behind when I see other women succeeding at their dreams or running their family a certain way, I experience a genuine celebration dance going on inside my heart. Because she has found her own way, and I have found mine. And that's just the best of both worlds. Chapter 18. Make it plain. Where there is no vision, the people perish. Proverbs 29:18. As our family started going on vision retreats and paying attention to the threads that tie us together, we've discovered something alarming and breathtakingly beautiful. We found that our whole family has a similar heartbeat that just takes on different roles. It's almost like that of an orchestra, all instruments working together for the same melody, each with different and necessary parts and sounds, some similar, some opposite. But we never would have noticed had we not written our dreams and passions down and taken some time to mull them over. It reminds me of the verse in Habakkuk 2:2, when God tells Habakkuk to write the vision, make it plain. Although I don't know the exact interpretation of this verse, and I'm not sure if writing down a vision for your life is exactly what it means, I do find it interesting that God goes on to say, so that others may run with it. And that seems like pretty spot-on advice to me. Something we've learned through intentionally seeking God together for our family's vision is to move forward only in unity. God is a God of unity, and if you seek him, he won't lead you and your spouse in different directions. So if you're not on the same page about a decision, stop. Do not move ahead without unity. Moving forward with something when there is division is laying the foundation for an I told you so conversation later. So we just don't do that anymore. If you aren't in unity on something, keep praying. Keep laying down your own desires and picking up God's. Keep leaning in. Keep listening. Keep writing down your dreams and visions and looking for common threads. And wait until pattern and unity reveal themselves. Once you have unity, you have a solid foundation to move forward. As we continued to write things down, we discovered that despite being so different, we all have very specific passions that build well upon each other. Here are some of our findings. I am a dreamer, shocker, and a builder, a connector of hearts and igniter of possibility. I adore village living and I live for family dinners and rooms full of people laughing and sharing stories late into the night. I feel most alive when I can help others live free and loved and help them move past whatever hurts have come their way. And you know what? My whole family feels this way too, in all different ways. While I dream of owning a farm with patio lights strung high from trees, decorating beautiful dinner parties for people, and collecting chicken eggs to give away, my family has dreams that intertwine with mine. Ava, our oldest, dreams of baking and coffee shops and selling her art in a cute little shop. Isaiah, our 10-year-old, can't stop talking about the animals we will have and what we will serve for breakfast at the bakery. He talks about big trucks, working the farm, and setting up community movie nights on the side of the barn. And Isaac, my favorite human, just wants to serve everyone. Me, the kids, the community, people who visit the farm. He's amazing. And it makes him shine his absolute brightest when he gets to serve. I promise I can see the whole thing playing out as if we were actually already living it. He wants to keep up the land, run a coffee shop, manage the properties, and learn how to make things with his hands and piles of wood just like my grandpa did. As we continued to write down all the things and pray about them over the past several years, God began to refine our vision and create a clear path in our minds. We started to see more than a farm for just our family. We saw a haven, a safe place, a land of community and connection and family and belonging. We saw a ministry farm retreat center, Haven Hill Farm to be exact, a place for others to call home and awaken adventure. As we began to heal and experience more of the joy, freedom, and restoration God had for us, we also began to feel a tremendous burden an unbridled passion to help others find their way out of the woods and into the freedom found in the Father's heart. New dreams were birthed for this property we'd held in our hearts for so long, and we found ourselves planning, praying, and pondering the possibilities during most of our waking hours. What if we could create a space for couples and families and leaders and authors to return to rest and connect with the heart of God? A place to heal, experience new adventures, soak in community, rest in God, and laugh again. What if we could build a safe haven for them, we began to say. A luxurious, peaceful retreat to come to with their spouses or their kids, or to be alone with their thoughts and dreams. A place of connection and hope and grace and community and adventure. A place to commune with God and community and fill days with long meals, kayaking, tending animals, mountain climbing, or reading in the hammock. A place we wish we could have found when we were down and out, on the brink of destruction, divorce, and isolated depression, but couldn't. What if we could make a place like that? During these dream sessions, our farm took on a whole new life, and God began laying very specific things on our hearts. We will build 10 cabins, each with 2 rooms and a living area, sleeping 8 to 10 people. They will be comfortable enough for 2 couples or a family with children to make themselves at home for a weekend, a month, whatever they needed. We will have a few Airstreams about the property for people looking for solitude, writing a book, or needing time with their thoughts. The farm will ideally be 100 acres, but no less than 60. On another part of the property, we will build 2 or 3 houses for our host families. We will work together to keep up the farm, love the guests, and cultivate an environment of grace, hope, connection, and fully alive hearts. A community barn will be in the middle of the place. We will gather there often for music, dancing, painting, or even paintball. It will act as a gathering space for guests and visitors, as well as an event center for the farm and local community. We can imagine having worship nights in the barn and showing old movies on the side of it in the summer. We can see huge community gatherings for the local city. We will live fully alive for a cause greater than ourselves. The guest cottages will be a safe haven for people who have experienced trauma in some way and are just trying to find their way home again. It will be for those who have been lied to or hurt or have lost something great and are just trying to find who God really is again. It will be for the couples who have lost the passion they once held dear and the artists who need space to be and process and create. It will welcome the pastors who are tired and the burned out people who need to be inspired and the orphans who finally found family in someone's arms. The farm will be for the people who need quiet and laughter, love and truth, and who most of all need a family to give their legs the strength to hold them up again. Maybe they will come for a weekend or maybe a few months, but we will love on them and stand by them and basically be to them what we needed someone to be for us these past few years. Because I truly believe that our pain gives birth to our purpose. And our cries teach us how to respond to the cries of others. Most of all, we see home and belonging, a place where love wins and failures fall in the light of His glory. We see redemption and wholeness and laughter. We see purposes unveiled, families restored, and hearts coming alive. And as with everything we've lived for, we see this farm as a place where women and families and marriages can uncover the heart of God for their lives and walk in the fullness of their calling. Where passions can be birthed and gifts brought to life. A place where joy and adventure and laughter and story are thickly woven into our fabric. We see it as the heart of our ministry that lived online for so many years, taking on tangible form. A place where we can meet people face to face every day, serving them, loving them, equipping them, and unleashing them into their fullest and freest selves. A place where we can wash people in the love and grace of God and see their hearts and relationships burst forth in a new freedom and passion. There will be chickens and goats and hopefully an English Mastiff puppy or two. We will smile and laugh and we will feel alive and free and purposeful and at peace. This is our family's vision. And now that it's written out, it seems so clear, so possible. We don't know how, but we are believing that somehow, in a way only God can do, He will bring us a property to build the farm on. And He will bring along people and families to link arms with us to make it happen. We aren't about to try to guess how this will all happen. But I do know that God has put this vision on our hearts, brought us into unity, and prompted us to write it down for a reason. So I think it's safe to say He has something up His sleeve. I firmly believe that as much as I fought staying in Oregon, surrounded by these wet forests, God is about to show up in this state in bigger ways than I can fathom. I believe there is rest and peace and Selah in the mountains He crafted here, and that the people needing the space to call home actually need it to be remote and uncharted. I believe there is so much magic in going off the beaten path, and I'm so thankful that is where God is calling us. God, please work. Please move. Please complete the good work you have started in our family. Please don't delay. Let everything here be my prayer to you, and change my heart if these don't line up with your will. Move, Jesus, please. My heart is heavy and weary. I need to see you part the seas in my life and move mountains in my story. If you, like me, have things swirling in your head, if you've longed for clarity, if people keep asking you what you really want, give yourself this gift. Here today, write the vision and make it plain. Draw a mark in the sand saying that today you are believing for these things that you know God has put on your heart for a purpose. Then let's sit on the edge of our seats together and watch God move. Chapter 19, Legacy. Please think about your legacy because you're writing it every day. Gary Vaynerchuk. I opened the door and made my way out to the hallway where guests were being welcomed. Ava stood there, 11 years old, tall and beautiful, with a stack of programs in her hand. She was strong and brave and ready to be a friendly face on a somber day. Just beyond her and outside, I watched in awe as person after person made their way to greet my grandma. The line felt miles long and kept growing. I'd never seen anything like it. As soon as some people were welcomed inside, others appeared at the back of the line outside to fill in the gaps. My family filed into the front row and got as comfy as they could on the cold wooden pews. I couldn't join them. I just couldn't bear to. I stood back, watching, waiting, letting the magnitude of it all wash over me like poetry. I could see the entire church from where I stood swaying and soothing a sleeping babe in my arms. Pew upon pew, filled with friends of old and family overflowing. As I soaked it all in, a deep conviction fell upon my heart from what was unfolding. With more of Grandpa's family on the other side of eternity than on this one, this little church was still filled to the brim with lives changed by his goodness and love. As we sang hymns and told stories, I was struck by the impact of a life lived out in simple, everyday love. The kind that our parents grew up with and Andy Griffith talked to Opie about. My heart became burdened with the fast-paced society we call home and the depravity of the what's next, if your dream doesn't scare you, it's not big enough, hustle till it hurts movements. The pastor stood in front of a communion table my grandpa built with his bare hands and began to speak. He talked about how grandpa just showed up places. He recounted coming home to find grandpa rototilling the parsonage yard to help prepare the ground for a garden. He told stories of the years and years my grandpa spent showing up and mowing the church's lawn without ever being asked. Grandpa spent his whole life showing up for people. And on that sunny day in October, they all showed up for him. I didn't say much that day, or the rest of the week for that matter. I just kept envisioning the line of people that extended down the church steps and into the parking lot. Face upon face, life upon life, opportunity upon opportunity that Grandpa seized to show love in one more way. I imagine that heaven probably had a very similar scene that week, except instead of the lines of people walking toward my grandma offering hugs and condolences, it was a crowd of those who'd gone before him lining up to welcome Grandpa home. The passing of a life can hit us like a raindrop of information or an ocean of emotion. One causes us to pause, think for a moment, and quickly move on, while the other leaves an uncontrollable current of memories, surges of laughter, aching tears, and cries that burst forth, causing our entire bodies to shake and our bellies to groan, all depending on the relationship we had with the life gone before us. The following weeks were a dance of anger, tears, tiny smiles, and introspection. I just kept seeing the faces, and I couldn't shake them. As they stared back at me in my mind's eye, I began to wonder, what faces would show up for me? Would anyone care? Would anyone come? I wish I could say that I have poured so much love and community and servant-hearted hospitality into my world that I quickly envisioned a similar line at my funeral. But the life I had been living didn't feel deserving of a standing room only celebration into heaven. It more accurately lined up with a table for 10 filled with our extended family and maybe a few friends from Bible study. The hours I spent in the church that day, prepping for Grandpa's service and hugging all of the guests until the hall was empty, felt like a call home. It was an invitation into a life I had been too busy to notice. My own. Running an online business and leading an international women's ministry are beyond amazing experiences. I find my heart gleaming with gratitude at the mere thought God would entrust me with such things. But amid the drive and dedication, the striving in social media, I suddenly realized I was missing the very best thing. My actual own life. At times it can feel as if I live in two worlds, my work life and the one surrounded by grazing horses and giggling children, both wonderful, both important, both needed. But somewhere along the path, I'd opened the doors of my heart to feel burdened by family and exhilarated by productivity. I don't know if it was the accolades, the buzz of creativity, or the fact that I finally got to dress up in grown-up clothes, free of peanut butter fingerprints, and participate in an inspiring conversation. Whatever it was, it snuck in undetected for years, and almost got away with stealing away the very best pieces of my heart, the ones that come alive in this place I call home. I felt as if I were the only woman on earth torn between two loves like this, and the guilt almost ripped me in two. But as I started sharing my story with others, something phenomenal began to unravel, a pattern. Turns out it wasn't just me. Stories from the lives of women all around me began to echo in my heart. Stay-at-home moms who felt torn